Commander Rickard, Reel 28. Now, we're on the Belfast, going out to the Far East. Past Aden, what's the next thing you remember?
A long, hot trip with all the problems of sunburn and sailors being bored and arranging deck hockey and various forms of exercise, which the officers required to take part in as well. Physical training of different sorts, competitive training of doing various things, 2 press-ups, jump a couple of planks or whatever on the quarterdeck, playing deck hockey, rigging the swimming bars, the same thing we'd had for the Neptune party at home. Different things every day to exercise the sailors and get the ship looking lovely by the time we reached Singapore, because the Admiral would no doubt wish to know what sort of ship was coming out for him. The first thing we actually did when we got to Singapore was to go into dry dock. Although we did need the certain amount of anti-fouling restoring, and I wanted to get at the side and polish it and so on, because I'd persuaded, I think, the Simonized manufacturers that if they would be good enough to provide me with some free Simonized, I might actually mention what it was that was making the after turret and the after screen gleam so much. The result, I had a lot of free Simonized on board.
What is Simonized?
Simonized is a polish provided for motor cars. And the captain of the quarterdeck was absolutely delighted to have this, because he could polish the things. And I was very reluctant to have the after turret fired at all, because it might damage the paintwork down there. So the gunnery officer and I were on different sides about that. But on the other hand, you could clean it off and get the salt off it and bring it up to shine again. And it looked absolutely gorgeous, especially with the huge silver bell hanging on the after screen. So I was concerned that the ship would not only be efficient and seaman-like point of view, but actually look lovely as well, because the admirals traditionally were pretty keen to have lovely ships as well as ones which could do their stuff. But when we got down to Singapore, we popped into dry dock, which was the nearest approach to hell that you can imagine, because without the sea around you, you can't work all the systems, and so you don't have all the ventilation you would like to have. And we were jolly glad to get out of that lot. But we had a chance to actually go around and see the place. Orchids and the orchid farm, the amazing war memorial in Singapore as well, where one became aware of the ghastly murder committed by mistakes made and the Japanese taking advantage of them. Very frightening indeed. So one started to go short. Then I found that I was having to liaise with rubber planters and with the oil palm industry as well. We were sort of allocated to them, so we set up liaison with them. Then I found that the paymaster commander's brother was commanding a battalion of Gurkhas up in Malaya as well, because the emergency was still on, although we were gaining over the terrorists, Chinese terrorists, who were working in the jungles there. And the roads had been cut back either side into the jungle, about 100 yards each side, to make it slightly more difficult to catch you by surprise when you were driving along them. But deeply interesting, new to me entirely, and therefore very exciting. Going up to see Chinese temples, amazed to find the builders, in fact, were women very often, carrying vast weights in order to build things. Discovering the primitive bushmen, in fact, on the way up, who were shooting monkeys with blowpipes and arrows tipped with poison that brought them out of the trees. Very, very interesting indeed. I loved it. And went up to the caves and so on. In order to keep in contact with these people, we did have a Land Rover on board, and I was qualified to drive the thing as well. So the gunnery officer and I went up and made contact with the people we were to liaise with. And that was in itself enormous fun. And at Christmas 1959, we'd established ourselves well enough to...
That's when you got there, December.
Yes, December. We didn't stay in Singapore all that long, but we set off for Hong Kong with our admiral on board.
Now, who was the admiral?
Admiral Begg. Vice Admiral Begg, who became First Sea Lord, I think.
And what was he like?
Very difficult to find out, because the admirals are not people you breeze up to and sort of chat to, unless they obviously want to chat to you. He was on board and circling command Far East for really quite a long time. And I got to like him increasingly. Whenever the admiral was on the quarterdeck, of course, the starboard side of the quarterdeck was his. The captain jolly well had to walk up the other side of the quarterdeck if he was there. And if both of them were there, no other officers walked up and down the quarterdeck at all, unless they were invited to go and talk to the admiral or the captain. And various problems gradually arose, but they weren't apparent in our first trip up to Hong Kong at all.
Now, what was this first trip to Hong Kong?
First trip to Hong Kong was really just to get there. And we fueled on the way up there from a tanker called Wavemaster. And we did so in the tail of a typhoon. So it was a very interesting exercise, seaman-like exercise, for all the things we'd practiced in the calm waters of the Mediterranean. Sailors could see for themselves that this was something we really had to do for real and to be rather good at it, or else they might get washed over the side or the thing wouldn't work. But arrived in Hong Kong, I found that the group of ladies who had introduced themselves to me and got a contract for me for cleaning the ship's side when we were up in Hong Kong really did exist. I must admit to feeling perhaps that they had been invented as the receiver of a spoof. But Jenny's side party provided seven junks manned by ladies whose job it was, under my direction, to clean and paint the ship's side. In addition to that, they provided someone to run the ladies' loo when we had cocktail parties on board, and the most beautiful little girls dressed in exquisite silk. So we used to hand things round at cocktail parties. We had them on board. And the current Jenny, whose name was actually Sui Moi, was the daughter of the woman who'd started this for the British fleet in round about 1922, after the First World War. And that old lady was still alive. And so I felt the need to give her face by calling officially upon her in the boats they lived in Sampan Bay, I think it was called, where the boats were secured in such a way that there were open streets of water and then perfectly secured boats in double rows on either side of the open streets of water. And in order to give even more face to this thing, I said I would go in uniform, medals, sword, the lot, my long white uniform, and sit in the captain's motorboat on the white linen covers to the seats, which I'd had blue piping sewn on by the sailmaker, with Sui Moi beside me, with everybody looking at her from the Chinese boats, therefore thinking how wonderful it was. But at the entrance to the Sampan village, there was a little boat with two children in it, about 10 feet long, one single oar at the stern to propel it, and they were in the way. And so my boat's crew, who were standing rigidly to attention with their arms folded and the boat hook vertically between the feet of the barman and the stern sheetsman, were getting slightly agitated by these two little children in the way. And I said to Sui Moi, can you get them out of the way? And so she grinned at me and she said, there's my children. So I said, well, what are they doing in the way there? They want you to get in the boat with them. So I realized that I was being set up for an opportunity to make an absolute blithering idiot of myself by falling in. So I duly clambered into this very wobbly little boat in my sword and medals and all the rest of it, thorough disapproval from the coxswain of the boat, my coxswain, and the barman, who were quite convinced I was completely wrong to do this awful thing. And then the children, who were totally delighted and actually very good at handling their own little boat, then duly rowed me with a single oar business at the back, with the huge boat following about 30 feet behind and the sailor's arms folded, looking very pompously cross. And we got to the boat, and there were about six or seven boats belonging to the same family. And they, the first person I was introduced to was the original Jenny, who was very old and somewhat blind, but her role on board was to look after the younger children and stop them going into the drink. And I said, how on earth can she do that? And so am I. I said, you look at her. She's got curtain rings on her fingers, and each one is secured to a line going up to the deckhead and through a pulley and then round the waist of one of the children. And she said something in Chinese to Granny and the children, and a couple of them, grinning like apes, hurtled towards the side of the sampan, and Granny felt the weight coming on and just leant back and held. So the children swung up in the air saying, "Wee!" in Chinese, and coming back inboard again. And all round this boat were unexpected things, permanent fishing going on with keep nets so that any fish caught could be put in a keep net. Chickens stuck out over the side of the boat so the droppings went into the sea. But they had fresh eggs, didn't they? And to my astonishment, the sort of senior boat had one part about 8 feet long, totally cleared with modern furniture and a modern desk and a light in it. And I said, who is this for? What is this for? And it was explained to me that that was for Soemoy's son, who was being educated ashore and who was required to work very hard, and that meant very hard indeed if you're Chinese, so that he would be able to get a job in a government office ashore and therefore exercise squeeze when he grew up. And all the books were there, and there was the grinning boy himself who had been brought back for this great occasion, and he spoke good English. And it was very impressively organized, little group of Chinamen doing their thing. Chinese ladies particularly, and they were superbly efficient. And what they got out of it, I didn't have to pay them in any way for this service. What they got was the right to dispose of all waste from the ship, gas from the ship. And as we took on board a very large amount of boxes of tins of food or tins in wooden boxes and so on, what they were actually making money out of was the wood from the boxes and the tins, which they would open up and flatten out and use in building things or whatever they did use them for ashore. And this was, they would meet us, or where they knew when we were coming in. How they knew, I haven't the faintest idea, but they also knew when I'd been appointed to Belfast a year before we were even setting sail for the Far East. So their intelligence was first class. But whenever we arrived in harbour, all of our sampans were out at sea, ready to greet us. And the last time we left there, before we paid off, they were all there firing off fireworks by the horde to celebrate their association with us. And it was very moving in many ways, because they were quite big seagoing boats. Ah Lee, very interestingly, wrote to Peggy when we got out to the Far East. And you remember he had been in our house before we left Plymouth. Well, as he couldn't write English himself, the only way he could write a letter was to pay a writer ashore in Hong Kong to do it for him. And what he wrote with proper address for Peggy: "Dear Madam, I am very sorry to leave UK and yours on the way back to Hong Kong. When I go back Hong Kong, my son Kwong Ping has already go to school study. At present time, I also has a daughter. She's face was the same as me, black hair and eyes. I am very glad to see my family. They are thank you very much for commander's command in the ship. I hope you and your child. God will bless them, though, strength and happy forever. Yours truly, R. Lee. Well, throughout this time in the Far East, there were, of course, endless letters written to and fro, various events, and one of them I can only describe because it was, I had an artist on board who was a sailor, and he produced a card which could be reproduced for anybody at home who would dare send it home. And it was a picture of an extraordinary drunken sailor pulling himself on board up a gangplank with his tongue hanging out and with unshaven horrors all over him. And the letter which it was proposed that should be sent is, "Dear Mum, I had a nice time in Hong Kong. We are all looking forward to our going back there." I don't think many of them sent them home. But here was, for me, of course, quite extraordinarily, a different civilization, which I knew nothing about before I went out there at all. I wasn't very well briefed on this at all. But I noted at the time that Christmas was gastronomically and physically exhausting. And thrown over the rails of the ship when we were alongside, and quite illegal, were a whole lot of advertisements. In manuscript, English, tea, choice of preserves and fancy cakes, bread and butter and tea, and supper, kidney soup, roll and butter, etc. With a place whereabouts they could go. And one particular one was addressed to the commander. Fascinating the extent to which they went in order to sell whatever it is they were trying to sell there.
And who were you joining the rest of the fleet at Hong Kong, or was it just?
We were usually by ourselves, but we did have, there were some destroyers in the Far East fleet. Not many. But I saw very little of them unless they were lying alongside, when as commander of the flagship, I was usually either senior to or knew the captains of the destroyers. And I found that it was great fun and very friendly stuff. But during this time, we had a trip up to India. And we went to a place called Vishakhapatnam. And there was a new program for the visit, etc., open to visitors and all that sort of thing. Lunch at the Caltex oil refinery for officers. Reception on board Belfast. A film show on board, Sincerely Yours. Curry lunch for the ratings. Lunch for Flag Officer Second in Command. Dinner for the Commander of Eastern India. And endless hockey matches and deep sea fishing as desired and so on. Much of this was in fact ruined by the fact that we had a problem with the evaporators which made fresh water for us to drink on board. So in order to shut down the evaporators and clean them, they were getting covered in salt or something inside, we took on board a lot of water from the Vishakhapatnam which we were told was fit to drink. And it became apparent by morning that it was not only not fit to drink, but it was actively poisonous because we had, that we hadn't have enough heads in the ship to cope with the disasters which were going on. And once again, I had to hose out the ship from end to end. And ashore, there were other things. There were particular spirochetes, which some of the sailors took on board, which were incurable, and they had to be sent home to die. And It was altogether a rather more fearsome visit than I had expected from the official program of what. Yeah, I was lucky to escape any of the ailments which, in fact, everybody else caught, probably because I was still drinking fresh lime juice or something. But I was very lucky also to be made, like the other officers, a member of the Officers Club ashore, Army Officers Club. The one thing we were required to do when we went ashore is to take a chit which certified that we were alcoholics. Otherwise, we would not be allowed to drink any alcoholic drinks in the club. And when one went to the club there, and in Madras later, all the English officers who, for a century or more, had been chairman of the club or president of the club, etc., who had their photographs or paintings there, the only thing that had changed in these clubs was the colour of the face of the chairman and the president. They were following, in almost slavish detail, some of the English customs which had stemmed from Victorian times.
Anything else about your visit to India?
I was invited to go and shoot in Madras by the officers there. And I was to be there, please, at 4 o'clock in the morning, which was a surprise. And we drove out, I don't know where we went, but we drove for about an hour out into the Ulu somewhere. And when we got out, there were a whole lot of primitive grass huts with very primitive Indian people living in the grass huts, and little naked babies around the place. And we ignored them completely and marched past them and down to a huge lake before dawn. And there I was introduced to a totally black chap who was just wearing a loincloth and had a long pole and a dugout canoe. And it was made clear to me that I was expected to get into the dugout canoe, and whatever he was saying to me as he spoke no English was translated for me, that although it leaked a little bit, it was all right, because he had put some cow dung in the bottom and some fronds of banana on top, and so I would be all right. So I had my 12-bore with me, and I got into this thing. And I found that trying to sit down the normal way around, it was too narrow at the top, although it went out, was literally dug out. So I had to turn sideways to get my bottom in, and then sit down on the things I'd been given to sit on. And we went out in the dark with a chap standing behind me, poling it out. And I'd been told there were a lot of duck there. I didn't quite know what that meant. What I did know was that as dawn came up, one of the Indians fired his gun, and there must have been a dozen of these boats out on the lake by then, and it looked to me as though the whole surface of the lake rose into the air. I have never seen so many water birds in my life. And when you're shooting, the idea is you choose which bird you're going to shoot at, but in fact, it seemed to me that there were so many of them who just sort of fired the guns off, the birds would fall out of the air. Now, swinging from right to left, sitting down, is not too difficult with a gun. But occasionally the birds were coming over from left to right. And when I did that, I made the canoe rock. And that made the chap at the back almost fall in. And so in order to draw my attention to the fact I was doing something silly, and he spoke no English, what he did was to hit me on the head with his pole, which, when you've got a loaded gun in your hand, leads to problems. And one way or another, I think I shot an awful lot of birds, and there were lots of other canoes there to go and pick them up. You know, the officers were not required to dirty themselves by doing that. This was what they did. And there must have been hundreds of birds shot, I think, by everybody, but we never went back and counted them or did anything which would have been done or made certain they were dead, whatever. And I suspect that some of the villagers were collecting their lunch and supper for the next week. But it was very charming for everybody to do it for me.
Did you have any contacts with the Indian Navy?
On that occasion, I can't remember whether it was that occasion or a subsequent occasion. The organization of the Far East was the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization. And SEATA, as it was called, consisted of the British, the Indian Navy, the Ceylon Navy, and the Pakistan Navy, and the Malaysians as well. I didn't think there was anybody else. And there certainly was one occasion when we went to Ceylon, and we had exercised on the way with this very polyglot group of ships, all of whom had very strong beliefs that their navy was better than any, but the only certainty was that their people were much better people than whoever it was in the other ship. So, for example, the Pakistanis and the Indians, who'd been at loggerheads for quite a long time, and there'd been shooting war between them. To my astonishment, when I had to organize hockey matches and so on, and indeed play in them, far from being at loggerheads, they were saying, "Oh, it is good to see you. We have not met since Dartmouth. We were in Dartmouth together, and do you remember this, and do you remember that?" And they were delighted. But politically, it was very difficult indeed. From the personal point of view, the officers had so much in common, which was Royal Navy training in common, that they got on like a house on fire. Some of the political representatives did not get on quite so well, I felt, but I kept myself out of that and was very lucky not to be involved.
How serious was this? Was a CETO or exercise?
Very serious.
It was off
the local equivalent of NATO, in effect. And just who we would be fighting wasn't quite clear, but probably it might have been the Indonesians, for example, who were being extremely difficult under a chap called Sukarno at that time. Indeed, at Singapore, on one occasion, we thought we were going to have to evacuate all the British from Indonesia, the mainland, and we embarked a whole lot of Royal Marines with the object of landing them to hold a beachhead while we could actually take off the British civilians. But being ready for it, I think, probably demonstrated that we were serious about whatever we were saying to Sukarno, and the event never happened, but it frightened everybody rigid at the time. The exercises were jolly interesting, and I must say I enjoyed going ashore and finding that on the islands around Ceylon, the elephants were making their way from island to island, still as a sort of basic thing, because this is what the elephants have done ever since ever. And this was regarded as quite normal. There was a social round, of course, in all these places where we had to have formal parties or formal cocktail parties. But I have the permit still with me, which said for a local, I was alcohol permit for a habitual alcoholic in Madras in 1960, not transferable. And I had a little book of these things, and each of them gave me 1/24th of a unit of alcohol. And then I never found out how big a unit was, but they collected these little chits and gave you a drink.